Today's daf in Masechet Ketuvot, brought to you from Yerushalayim Yir HaKodesh, is daf Samach Tet, and we're holding right at the first word on the daf. So we've been talking about the concept of a dowry, which is, as its name in Hebrew, a dowry is called a nedunya, and its technical name here in our sugya has been parnasa, which is a little bit confusing, but sometimes we use parnasa for mizonot, so we've been careful to distinguish between it. But basically, we've got this idea that there are two different concepts, one of which is tnae ha'ktuvah, which is the way that the ktuvah protects a woman, and that includes the din of mizonot. And then we have an additional halacha that we ended up with yesterday, which is that the din of a dowry, which is supplied by the father after his death, is not part of the tnae ha'ktuvah. And actually, we had a machlokas whether it's open to an ongoing assessment of the psychology of the father. So if we don't have such an assessment, so then the halakha is that we go with isur nichasim. So we give 1/10 of the available property at that time, or if they're coming together, then we figure what would have been the total if each one would have been given a separate isur nichasim from the one that was left before. And we end up, for in a case of 10, with about 65%, whatever it works out in the case. That's how we came out yesterday, I'll leave it already. And then we had the three shitas that held that if we do have data, we rely on those data to give an estimate of what the father would have wanted to give. And there's a big difference, was the last thing that we learned, between the way that we can collect them. Because something which is part of the Tnae HaKtuvah has one din of collection, and something that is not part of the Tnae HaKtuvah has other dinim of collection. So as we know, I mean, nowadays, of course, there actually is a takona that we collect even the Tnae HaKtuvah, we collect even from the Taltalim, and we know that according to Rebbe, that we're able to collect from the Taltalim all of the Inyanim. But we came out yesterday, it's still going to be a major difference. The difference will be whether someone gives a deathbed command that he does not want any of his property being given as a dowry for his daughters. And that would be Nogea Rebbe Meir, says Mitzvah L'Kayem Divrei HaMeid. And we don't have a Chiyav in the Ketuvah, so he's not doing anything wrong. He's not a Chiyav. There's a remez in the Pasuk that it's a fine thing to do, and that it's a mitzvah about a deal, but there are cherets with your family. But if he specifically says he doesn't want it, we can't force it. Mashen Kein, if it were actually part of the ketuvah, his words are meaningless. I mean, he already created that she'ibud. So now what happened was that Rav wrote a letter to Rebbe. Now there's different, there's slightly different approaches to what this means. Talalei Rav, L'Rebbe Beni Chite. The word Chite is a rather strange way of referring to between the lines. And because of that, we find some of the early Mefarshim go against the Yerushalmi, where it says, Beferish Beni Shitasa, that it was between the lines of a letter. And they understand Chite to mean the Chutim, the fact that there were a lot of Shilas here. Each one had been posted as a separate shayla, and then had been sewn together. So benechite would mean along the sewing threads, because Rav remembered an additional, right as the shliach was taking the letter, he remembered an additional question. So he wrote it along the tefer. So he wrote it, therefore, in the margins between the different pages. Whatever it is. But the point is that he didn't write this openly. Now, what it appears from Rashi is that this was a letter that was not a bunch of shilas. And he wrote this between the lines of a social letter, you know, describing his daughter's wedding or asking how Rebbe's feeling, whatever. Between the lines of that letter, he inserted the shila, which, of course, I mean, so why did it have to be between the lines? So here there are, in fact, those who taina that this is specifically before the time that they had been matir, writing Torah Shebaal Peh in the freehand fashion that we do today, which is everybody thinks it's even a mitzvah to write up Torah, even if it's, you know, nobody's interested and so on. And therefore, he was being careful to make sure that it wasn't begetter writing up Torah Shebaal Peh. So writing up requires consecutive lines. We didn't want to put it consecutive, so we put it between the lines of a letter. Possibly. That's Achreinu Shetara, anyway. Anyway, this is what he wrote between the lines, or whatever it means. Achim eshishi ibdu mahu. So what if the brothers of this girl, who's supposed to be getting the Yisur Nechasim, what if they created a lien on the property? Can she still go ahead and collect it from the against the lien? And Tosfos claims that this is included in the discussion before. So in other words, taking for granted that Mizonos, of course, is not recoverable. The only issue over here is the Yisur Nechasim, because that we seem to have agreed on before. At least that's the way the halacha was. You could not collect against a Shi'ibud from the Chasim Yishubadim for any of the Tanei HaKetuvah. So Tosfos understands it's not reopening the question. It's asking, how do we paskin legabi the din of Yisur Nechasim? Now, Rabbi Chiya was right there when Rabbi opened this letter. And Rabbi Chiya said to Rabbi, I don't understand this language of if they she'ibdu. I mean, how do you say she'ibdu? In English, we have a judicial concept of encumbrance. So if something is mishu'ubad, it's encumbered. That's a very strange way to write a shaila. I mean, you could have said if they sold it, or if you want to talk about something that is a lesser shibud than a sale, you could talk about if they made it into a mortgage or it was a mashkan. Even if it's a mashkan suri, where he's able to continue to be nene from the property in the interim. But the bottom line is that this is a funny language. And Rabbi Chiya said, what's he like thinking, Rav, when he writes you this funny word? So Rabbi said, Omar Lay, what do you care? Basically, he's asking Shi'ibud whether it's machru or mishkanu, because either way, it's the same halacha. Bein machru or bein shemishkenu, we will be motzien for parnasa and not for mizonot, as we've discussed all along here. And as we said, if something has a concrete amount attached to it, then it's not considered to be destructive to the real estate market to allow people to recover, because it can be traced how much is owed. But if it's an open-ended shibud, such as somebody owes for the mizonot, which who knows how long and who knows how much that's going to be over there, we can't possibly allow tiruf from lekuchos or the violation of any type of encumbrance, because that way we're going to destroy the real estate market. People are not going to give mortgages on property that one day some lady is going to come along and say, I'm owed Yisur Nechasim and I intend to collect it from your mortgage. That's crazy. So because of that, we will not be motzim for Parnasa, but we will, I mean, for Mizonot, but we will for a dowry, because that we knew Lechatzila. What do you mean? That's outrageous. You knew perfectly well that he left these daughters and that they were going to get 10%. You could calculate what 10% is and see whether he's got enough to support your lien against him. Anyway, but what Lemaisa was Rav thinking? I mean, why didn't Rav use a normal word? So Rav, I mean, if Rav was talking about a case where it was sold, so let him write that, you know, dichtov machro. If he's asking what the din is legabi amashkan that was made on the soda that was supposed to be hers for collecting her Yisur Nechasim, so let him write mishkanu. Ah, no, Rav is smarter than that. Rav understood that he wants a definitive answer from Rebbe. So because of that, his definitive answer is going to require details. Because let's say, says Rav to himself, let's say if I write to him, what would be the din of brothers who sold? So if he answers me, Hanecha Yishalachli, I don't care if they sold. We're still going to be able to be terif from Lekuchais. So then obviously if we can be terif from Lekuchais, even if it's completely transferred to somebody else, Koshkein, if it's just a mortgage that somebody has on it. But what if Rebbe writes me back, Yishalach li ein motzi'in, then I'm in trouble. Because if he says you cannot collect it, I have to think to myself, maybe Rebbe's saying you cannot collect it because we transferred ownership. Masha'in kein, if it was just a mashkan, maybe you could collect it. And I want to have a definitive psak. So I'd have to go back and ask him, Akati Mishkanoka Miboile, I still wouldn't have this psak. And if I would write him Mishkano, what the din is, if he answered me, even Mishkano, you can't collect it. Okay, so now for sure, if it was transferred, Mokru, for sure you can't collect it. But what if he says to me, if it was a Mashkin, you can't collect it? I'm not going to know what the halakha is if you sold it. So therefore, I'm going to write him this crazy word. If they were Mishibdo, that will force him to define what the answer is. I'm going to sit there and write all kinds of long, separate questions. Ektov lo sheibdu, which is mashmahachi, mashmahachi. And then Rabbi Chiya, of course, is going to sit and complain about who's this idiot writing this question. And Rabbi's going to have to answer both in him. Ha. Now, Rabbi Yochanan, surprisingly, argues on Rabbi. Rabbi Yochanan, Omar, echad zeh v'echad zeh, ein motzi. We don't even take Mishu'u Bonim for the dowry. So in other words, the parnasah, the mizonot, we've all long understood that. But Rabbi Yochanan seems to say that Rabbi is wrong. Now, the question is it that Rabbi Yochanan didn't know about this psak? That Rabbi says we definitely do take from Mishu'u Bonim for a dowry? And if he had known that Rabbi paskin this way, then he would have accepted the psak and he would have maybe Makabali would have said I was wrong. Odilma, Shmia Levelo Makabali. Or is Rabbi Yochanan insisting that indeed Rabbi is wrong? And we have a shita over here that says that you cannot be motzi from the Chasim Mishu Ubadim, even for Parnasa that is Nidunya, that is the dowry. Tashma. The Itma. Misha made Viniach Shtei Banot Uvein. Now, here's a fascinating question. This is a brilliant question. Imagine a situation like this. A guy dies leaving three children, two girls and a boy. Now, the first daughter goes in and gets married, and she takes her Isur Nechasim. But then what happens is that before the second daughter gets married, the boy died. Now, if the son dies, that means that the only heirs that are left are the daughters. And then, of course, the daughters are zocha in the entire property. How do we deal with that situation? Does the remaining daughter, who never had the opportunity to collect her 10% of the estate, do we first give her her 10% and then split the remaining estate between the two new heirs who are the daughters? Or do we say, look, you know, you're not going to collect your 10% because the 10% was only in a position where you're collecting from your brothers. I mean, over here, basically, you own the property. You can collect against yourself and your sister. That doesn't make any sense. It wasn't on that basis that we gave you the 10%. But she says, but look, but then it's not fair because the bottom line comes out that my sister ended up not having to split that 10%. So I feel it should be made up for me. So what do we do with that? So let's see that inside. Misha made vinyak shtepanot ubein. Because Maharishana, first daughter comes along, takes her 10%, not Laizu Nechasim. The second one, Laizpika, Shnian, Legibot, Achimet Habein, Omer Rabbi Yochanan. So Rabbi Yochanan says, in that case, the second daughter was Vitra. So basically, she loses her rights. She cannot get her own 10th first because you're claiming a 10th against a sister. And the whole din of claiming a 10th is against the brothers who are the heirs, and not when you yourself are the heir with a sister. So Rabbi Yochanan did not make any sense, according to Rabbi Hanina. And Rabbi Hanina said to Rabbi Yochanan, that's crazy. If even in a case, look, consider this. Gedolam Yisru Amru, the Rabbanan said that even in a much more powerful claim than this, namely, that you actually sold the property. Your brothers have actually sold the property. We paskin that motzi'in leparnasa, but not lemizonot. Now, whose psak was that? That was Rebbe's psak, right? Remember that according to Rabbi Yochanan, that's simply not true. According to Rabbi Yochanan, he says we are not motzi'in for the parnasa. So basically, Rabbi Hanina says to Rabbi Yochanan, apparently ignorant of the fact that Rabbi Yochanan himself disagrees with the very assumption that he's bringing as a proof against Rabbi Yochanan. So he says to Rabbi Yochanan, I mean, how can you say such a crazy thing? If we would take out for this dowry, even if it was sold, and over here, it's still sitting there. It's in the estate, for heaven's sake. And she doesn't have to collect it from anybody else. She just has to take her She just had to take her piece of the action, right? And you're saying that she can take it from someone else who already paid good money for it, bought it, but she can't take it from the estate that's just sitting there waiting for her to take it. Now, this makes sense to you? Okay, now, so if it's the truth would have been that Rabbi Yochanan never even heard the Psak of Rebbe, then he should have said, what are you talking about, man? Who said that, right? Because Rabbi Hanina is saying something to him that he disagreed with, and you're saying maybe he never heard that Rebbe said that. So if Rabbi Hanina comes along and says, it's a given that we certainly are going to be able to go after a buyer, so why can't we go after the estate directly? What should have been Rabbi Yochanan's response? What are you talking about? Who said that we would be able to go after a buyer? But Rabbi Yochanan doesn't say who said that. Rabbi Yochanan calmly accepts what it is that Rabbi Hanina said, and he doesn't change his mind, but he doesn't attack him on the attack that Rabbi Hanina had on him. So obviously he knew about Rebbe. He's not going to ask who said that. I know who you're relying on. You're relying on Rebbe. I disagree. Fine. And Rabbi Yochanan, of course, has a din of a tana when he wants to. Remember, Rabbi Yochanan and Rav are both in that interim transitional period in which they have dinim of a tana when they assert so. And otherwise, he would have accepted Rebbe's opinion. But he didn't accept it. So im ita, if he never even heard of it, shouldn't he have said to Rabbi Hanina, where'd you get that from? Man amra? So apparently, he did hear it, and he argues. No, says the Gemara. Maybe Rabbi Yochanan actually did not know about Rebbe. And the truth is that as soon as he heard of Rebbe, he was makabalit. So that initially, what are you asking? What did he mean to argue? That's what you're asking. And you bring me a raya from, I don't know, 30 years later that this maisa happens, that he doesn't say who said. Maybe that's because at this point, he knows who said, not because he knew at the time who said. Well, what do you mean? If he did, then why didn't he accept Rabbi Hanina's proof? I'll tell you why. Because Rabbi Yochanan holds that even if Rabbi is right, and even though now 20, 30 years later, I agree with Rabbi's psak, I feel that Rabbi Hanina's argument is irrelevant to this case. It makes no sense to say that just because I would be able to recoup my dowry from a buyer if the brothers had sold it, that therefore, of course, I could certainly recoup my dowry directly from the estate. No, it sounds good, but it's just a CNN argument. Because Shine Hatam, Dika Rav Chabeta. Look, we need to take into consideration the fact that this award of a dowry of 10% was given when you are not rich. But over here, you yourself got the entire estate. So why would we initially give you a piece of the estate when it's going to be 50% yours anyway? But what do you mean because she's rich? And what if she had won the lottery in between? You're telling me we won't give a dowry to a daughter who wins the lottery? That's crazy. Omar Le Rav Yema Le Rav Ashi, what are you saying? That Elamiyata Ashkecha Metzia Be'alma. Let's say that she ends up becoming rich because she found a diamond ring or she won the lottery. Over there, she's also rich. So we're going to say that because she got the equivalent money by accident, therefore we don't give her the Yisur Nechassim? That doesn't make sense. Omale said, Rav Ashi, it's not what I meant, obviously. I meant the Ravach Beta from the very same Nechassim that she had the right to take her dowry from. So it doesn't make sense that we're going to give her the right to collect out of her own estate against her sister. We're going to give her the right to take money. So she says it's not fair because my sister ended up getting her 10% before we split it. Life isn't fair. What does that have to do with the issue? So things worked out that way. But certainly she was not awarded a 10% of an estate that she owns. That's all. And I still maintain that that's true. Now, what this opens up in our minds is the question of whether the dowry of 10% is viewed as an additional right of inheritance, or is it just basically the equivalent of a loan? In other words, she's collecting as a normal creditor. So that's the question. Now, a Maamar came along and said, look, when the Takana was that where we don't have any other data, we'll give her 10% of the estate. What that meant was we give her the status of a Yoresh. So now she's a Yoresh at the estate, and she's in the same position as her own brothers. That's how it works. We're going to see how a nafkamina that makes. Amalei Rav Ashi la Maamar, what are you saying? Are you saying that if the brother wants to give her cash, he can't give her cash? So the brothers say, okay, we're going to give you cash for your dowry. And just get out of here because we don't want our sister to have 10% of our field. So you're saying, no, she can say, listen, I'm in the same position vis-a-vis the field that you are, and I want to continue owning the field. You can't buy me out. Is that what you're saying? That ilu boyle saluki bezuze de lo matzi mi saluka achinami? So Maamar says, yes, absolutely. That's exactly what I'm saying. Well, what about if they want to give her one of the fields? Let's say you keep this field as your 10%. Just get out of our minds, will you please? You're telling me achinami de lo matzi mi salikla? They can't? Oh, my lay, exactly. That's precisely what I'm telling you. You're not impressing me by telling me, how could it be? How could it be? What do you mean, how could it be? That's what it is. You don't have any kasha. You know, you're trying to shake me by saying, are you going so far? Yes, I am going so far. That's exactly what I meant. What do you think? I am stupid. I don't understand the implications of saying she's a Yoreshah. Now, Rav Ashi says, absolutely not. A bat, in terms of collecting her dowry, is nothing other than any other creditor. So she is a ba'alat chov, and that's it. V'af ha-Maamar hadar, but the truth is, we know that a Maamar who came out with this very, big chiddush, that she has a din of a yoreshet, in the end he changes his mind. How do we know? Because Rabbi Yumi, Bereder of Nichumi, said that once I was in the courtroom of a Maamar, and this woman comes into the court, and she's demanding her dowry. And I could tell that in the event that the brothers wanted to give her cash, they could have cashed her out. How do I know that? I'll tell you how I know. Because one of the brothers says to his sister, you piece of dirt, if we wanted to, we could buy you out completely and throw you out of this property. So don't think that you're going to get anywhere by getting a court ruling against us that we have to give you the 10%. And Maamar heard that, and he didn't say anything. V'yishtik v'lo amalu v'lo midik. Now, the Rabbeinu Tam says an amazing thing based on this Gemara, halacha l'maisa, that a judge needs to respond to an irrelevant threat from one of the Balei Dinim to the others, even though it wasn't brought before the judge. Because otherwise, why should a Maamar say anything? It's not a Maamar's business. They want to yell at each other. The lawyers want to threaten each other. They can do what they want, like in a secular court. So you see from here, says Rabbeinu Tam, and this is what he used to do personally, that the whole idea of mishpat, that a courtroom is a place where reality is the din, and not threats, and not between the lines, and so on and so forth, that's part of a judge's responsibility. So a Maamar should have turned to them and say, you don't know what you're talking about. You couldn't buy her out. So why don't you just mind your own business and quiet until the courtroom paskens? That's what he should have said. Since he didn't, apparently he knew that it was actually true. But a Maamar himself last year said that actually they could not be misalik her, right? So apparently he changed his mind. That's how I know that he changed his mind. Okay, so now that means that we're all agreed that she has a din of a ba'alat chov. What is the practical implications of that, says the Gemara? Hashtag amrit ba'alat chov havya. So I want to know, if she is a ba'alat chov, against whom is that chov addressed, Mr. Gershi? We like a full-on, you know? There we go. Too much contemplation going on during the daf. See? Okay. I didn't think it was Sesame Street. I thought it was about the human condition. So anyway, the question is, does the debt that exists that we're allowing her to collect, does it exist against the brothers, or is it a debt that's being collected from the brothers against her father, so to speak, who was the one that was responsible to give her the dowry of the Isinoklasia? Well, who cares? L'may nafkamina. Oh, makes a major nafkamina in two very important things. One is that if you are collecting from yitomim, and when we say yitomim, it doesn't matter how old they are, it means that it's a debt against their father. So if you're collecting from someone's father, so to speak, he is not expected to be aware of everything that took place in his father's lifetime. And therefore, if you want to collect, number one, you can only collect with a shvua that this had never been collected before. And number two, when you do collect from yitomim, you can only collect ziburit, the lowest quality property. Masha ein kein, if you were collecting directly from the guy who owes you money, the din is that a bal chov pays bebenonit. So there would be two very important nafkaminas. The nafkamina is lemigva lebenonit below shvua or ziburit bishvua. Which way is it going to be? My, what's the halacha? Oh, tashma. We have an actual beautiful case exactly like this, okay? What happened is that the daughter of Rav Ashi came to collect her own parnasah, her own nedunya, from, now here's what happened over here is that Rav Ashi's son, who was Rav Sama, died. And when Rav Ashi died, his brother, Mar Bar Rav Ashi, whom we're very aware, inherited him, and so did Rav Sama's son inherit Rav Sama's chelek. Now that means that when Rav Ashi's daughter is coming to collect her dowry, she's collecting against two people. One is her brother, Mar Bar Rav Ashi, and one is her nephew, the son of Rav Sama Bar Rav Ashi. And the halacha was that she collected from her brother, who is Mar Bar Rav Ashi, she collected benonit, without making a shvua. And when she collected from her nephew, she collected from Rav Sama's son, who was a grandson of Rav Ashi, only ziburit and with a shvua. So you see very clearly that to Mar Bar Rav Ashi, she had a direct claim, which means that her claim was not against her father, Rav Ashi, it was against her brothers, in which case she doesn't need a shvua, and she collects even from Benonis. Sholach Rav Ibn Nechemia, Rav Yosef, to Rabba Baravuna Zuta Minaharda. So this woman comes and she is the bearer of a letter. Now, in those days, somebody was coming from location A to location B, and she needed to collect something in location B. So a piece of property was in location B. What is she supposed to do without communication to be able to establish her claim to a property in location B when all of her proofs are back in location A, her witnesses, the story? So what they would do was they would go to the Beis Din in location A, get a letter from that Beis Din as to what was supposed to be done, and then they would bring the letter to location B. And the letter would say, give to the bearer of this letter X, Y, and Z, right? Okay, so that's what happened. So she was appearing before Rabba Bar Rav Huna in Naharda, and that's where the field was that she was supposed to be collecting. So she was carrying the following letter from Rabbi Nechemia ben Rabbi Yosef. Quote, when the bearer of this letter, when this woman was the bearer of this letter, appears before your court, go and collect the 10% from her father's property in your location, in Naharda, and that property will include even the base of the grinder, of the millstone, because that's considered to be connected to the ground and has a din of karka, and therefore she can recover from karka, but she can't recover from metaltum. Okay? Same thing happened by Rav Ashi. Rav Ashi says that, you know, when we were learning by Rav Kahana, they would collect, forget about the starubli. What about if there's rent coming in on a property? Now, that property is real estate. He used to collect even from the rent on real estate because he considered that to be karka. Now, Tosis points out this doesn't make sense. If the rent already came in, then it's pure metaltalin. And if it didn't come in yet, so how exactly are you collecting it? And what would be, you know, if there's a way that it's b'shubat, so then what's the chiddush? The point over here was that it was rented by the year. And what we used to do, what Rav Kahana would do, is that he would collect the entire rent, even for the half of the year that was already passed before the claim arrived, because schirut is only mishtalemet b'sof, in which case the chiddush is that you could collect the entire schirut at the end of the year as if it's metaltalin. Fine. Anyway, but this is another insight into what is, as if it were karka, I mean, into what is the difference between karka and metaltalin. Now, we once got into a very nasty confrontation in the wording of a letter. All right. So Rav Anan had a Beis Din, and he had the same situation where a woman had come and wanted to collect her 10%, and she needed to collect it from a location where Rav Huna was the Beis Din. So he writes a letter that goes as follows. Dear friend Huna, Huna Chavrin Shalom, Ki Atya Hayitita L'Kamach, when this woman appears before you bearing this letter, collect 10% of the rechas. Now, Rav Sheshes, was standing in front of Rav Huna when Rav Anan's letter was given to him, and he opened it up, and he was furious. Who the hell is Rav Anan to call me his friend? I'm no friend of his. This is an unbelievable chutzpah. So he turns to Rav Sheshes, and he says to Rav Sheshes, now I want you to give him the following message. And I mean the following message. I mean word for word. You got it? And if you don't say it word for word and you try to pretty it up, then I'm telling you right now that you should be in cherem. All right? So you got no choice. Now you're going to go to Rav Anan and you're going to tell him the following message. So, Anan, you're so smart. When you tell me I should collect, you know, you didn't provide any details. Now, did you? Am I supposed to collect from karka? Am I supposed to collect from metaltalin? And I got another question for you. Man yotiv be marzecha bereisha. Who sits on the front couch in the house of an ovel? Now, a marzecha is a very strange way of referring to an ovel. But obviously, what it was he was trying to say to Rav Anan is that you may think you're hot stuff because you're the guy that's in charge of the Beis Din over there. So consider if a guy walks into a house of Avelim and he sees the Ovel is sitting at the top of the top bed along the table. Does he conclude that the Ovel is the Godel Ador, or does he conclude that the Ovel is sitting Shiva? Thank you. Okay. So that should clarify your status of sitting in the front of the Beis Din. You ain't no Godel Ador, and don't think I'm your friend. So poor Rav Sheshes had to actually go and pretend he was a singing telegram and give this message to Rav Anan, which was extremely insulting. So anyway, so Rav Sheshes goes reluctantly to Rav Anan and he says, now listen, you know, he's sort of in the position of these guys that the Melech sends to Eliyahu HaNavi, you know, please, Eliyahu, don't burn us up alive, right? So we have no choice but to tell you this message. Okay, so he comes to Rav Anan and he says, now listen, Rebbe is a great Rebbe. My problem is that Rav Huna is Rebbe's Rebbe. And I was warned that I have no choice but to give over the following message by the Rebbe's Rebbe. The Shamute Shamit Bandelo Amarla, he put me into Cherem if I don't give you over this message by the very language, okay? But I promise you, if he wouldn't have done that, I never would have given you this message. All right, now I'm turning on the tape right now. I have nothing to do with this. Click. Anan, Anan. Mime v'karkoi o mime t'altalei. Uman yativ be'mir zachi b'reisha. Rav Anan was very insulted about this. And he goes to Mar Ukva and he says, can you imagine the way Rav Huna talks to me? Chazimar hechi shalach li Rav Huna. Take a look at what he sends me a message. Anan, Anan. And then he gives me this other message. I don't even know what the heck a marzichya is, you know, but I know what he's trying to say. So who sits at the table of Marzich? I don't know what he's doing to me. Lo yadana ma'aniyo. I don't even know what he's referring to. So Marukva says to him, okay. Just easy. Tell me exactly what happened. Because you're telling me half of the story. Okay. So Emily, easy. Just tell me easy, like, gufa duv de'echav. I want all the facts. Okay, so he tells him all the facts. So Marukva says to him, so let me ask you something. A guy like you who doesn't even know what the word of Marzecha is as the chutzpah to call Ravuna our friend Huna, you deserve everything you got. Well, boy, tough characters, let me tell you. So you call him Huna Chavri? I think he's absolutely correct in insulting you. Anyway, by the way, says the one, what is a Marzecha? Oh, a Marzecha is an ova. Where do we see that? Bichtiv ko amar Hashem. Al tavo beit marzeach. So Yirmiyahu is told, don't even go in to be Menachem Avelin, because you want to give over the message to Klal Yisrael that basically everybody's dead. There's going to be so many dead people lying around. Believe me, nobody's going to have time for any kind of Avelin. So therefore, the marzeach is a loshon of, Rashi says, mar, which is bitterness, and zach. Now, it is a very interesting nekuda. Rashi says, zach means that you lose your connection to reality. So you become like zachus hadas, you're completely out of it. So daita zocha, his lashon is mu'utaka. It's like he's out of touch with anything because he can't get his head around it. That's the lashon of mar v'zach. Fantastic insight into the emotional context of the deeper meaning of someone who is in pain on that level. But what is actually the answer? Who does sit at the top of the table? The one who sits on top of the table, the top couch is put, give it to the other. So here, Eov is talking about, used to be the people were mechabedim, and he would come in, and I would sit there like the head of the whole place, like a king in the middle of a secret service. And when I would walk in to give over tanchumim to the avelim, wait a minute, we're trying to prove that the one who sits at that is not the one who's giving the avelim. And you're bringing Raya that Eov said, as I came in, I was treated like the king when I came in to be Menachem Av. So it's the opposite. You're proving the opposite. Yenachem. I mean, Yenachem means he was being Menachem others, right? Yenachem means Acherim. Omrim Nachbo Bar Yitzchak Yin Nucham or Yin Nochim Ksiv. And that, since that's written without any indication, it'd be Yenachem, which should have an olive in it to indicate that it's not, or to make it clear. So therefore, we understand when he didn't want to say that he was the other, so he wrote it in that way. But what it really means is kasher yinucham or yinachem from others. Marzutra says, "I'll show you where we learn it from." Visar mirzach suruchim. What's the meaning of visar mirzach? That means sar. So that's the lotion of coming to something, right? Fine. And then, so when I am coming here to the Mirzach, Siruchim means that there's always extra that's left over. So we call that the Serach on the Mishkan. So we talk about the part that was Serach Odef, that extends further beyond. So what, which we mean, therefore, we take to mean in terms of the Midrash, Mar Vizach, somebody who is Mar Vizach, as Rashi explained, Nases Sar Lisruchim. He becomes the Sar, as if he's the king, to the people who are much larger than he is. There's Saruach along the Tzad. Very poetic way. Oh, my Rabbi Hilchata. Look, bottom line, Mimekar Koibolo Metatale, we only collect from real estate. I don't care whether we're talking about Mizonot, or we're talking about the Ktuvah, or we're talking about the Parnassah. We have no right to collect from Metatle. And as we've mentioned many, many times, at the time of the Gaonim, this was from the time of Rav Nuroi Gaon, and it's brought, as Tosis brings it in other Mechtavim of the Gaonim, they made a takona that nowadays, like we write in the Ksuvah itself, that afilu miglima me'akatvoy, you can take the shirt off my back to indicate that you're able to collect from anything, even the top. And now we are ready for that fabulous moment. Uh-oh. Beep, beep, beep. Oh.
I'm here. Zuk Tehillik Mishnah.
Lovely, lovely. See the difference when the hands on the cheek or the hands in front of you? Makes all the difference in the world. So, right now, you know, it's like the difference between, they put out this YouTube, the difference between an Ashkenazi Good Shabbos and a Sephardic Shabbat Shalom. Well, Good Shabbos. Yesterday was Ashkenaz. Today is Sephard. So we got some serious heart in it. So the Mishnah now talks about another issue that we haven't spoken about. We did raise the issue this morning when we talked about what happens if the father would say, I don't want to give money to my daughter's dowry, right? But this opens up another question. That's true. You're telling me it's not a chiyuv of the ksuva. I understand that he says, I'm not interested. The question is, when the father, before his death, would say something that he does want done, is there a mitzvah to perform according to the words of the deceased? So someone is dying and he gives a tzivui as his last will and testament. Does that have an halachic status that we're supposed to pay attention to it? So let's imagine a case where a man is dying. He wants to ensure that his daughter has a trust account that comes into her possession when she gets married. He doesn't know who she's going to get married to, and he doesn't trust the boy that she's going to fall in love with. So he doesn't want her to come into money, because then he may persuade her, give him the money, he'll invest it in some crummy business, blow all of his money, and so on. So what does he do? He gets someone to become a trustee, and that's called a shalish. So he makes a trustee before his death, and he sets up a trust fund. And in this trust fund, he leaves instructions that you are to buy a field for my daughter. Don't give her cash. You're to buy a field for my daughter, so that way, when she gets married, it will become part of her nechassim, either her nechassim aluk, depending on how it's brought in, or her nechassim tzon barsal. But in either event, it won't be directly controlled by whatever idiot of a husband she gets. Okay, so he dies leaving these instructions, and now the trustee comes to get a field, and the girl says, I found a great guy, he's a brilliant businessman, don't give me a field, because that's a waste, we're just going to have to sell the field. Give me the cash, because we want to invest in the business, and I trust him implicitly. He's not going to take it away from me. And he'll merit Neman Bali Alai. I trust my husband. So what should the trustee do? Yaseh shalish mashu shlash biyado, divrei Rabbi Meir. Says Rabbi Meir, look, you're a trustee man. You're not able to make new decisions. You were left with instructions and with cash to buy a field. You go ahead and you buy a field. Despite the fact that the girl is saying, listen, you idiot, we're going to lose 10%. If you get me the field, I'm going to have to pay taxes. Then I'm going to have to sell it. Then I'm going to have to pay more taxes. It's going to end up eating up my father's money. So don't be stupid and blindly do what he wants. I'm telling you, we're going to go sell the field anyway. Says Rabbi Meir, I don't give a hang. Do what you were instructed to do. Rabbi Yossi says, that's crazy. I mean, let's say that she gets the field. And she wants to sell the field. Do we have any way of stopping her? No. So, I mean, does it make sense to do something which is in her hands to undo anyway? So, she could sell this field right now. So what are you doing wasting money for? Okay. Now, we don't know who made this statement. The Gemara is going to analyze this last piece. When do we say this? And that's not sure whether that means when does Rabbi Yossi say we'll listen to her, or whether it's something that Rabbi Meir is saying, which we'll have to understand. But by medvarim amurim, only if she is a gedola, because if she's a gedola, it's true. She could sell this field if she wants. So what's the point of insisting on getting her a field when she's saying, I'm just going to sell the field? But if she's a ketana, so then who cares what she says? She couldn't sell it anyway because she's a minor. So, ein maaseh ketana klum. Now, there's a very important question over here, which is that, as we've discussed before, an heir or heiress does not have the right to sell the estate that she or he inherited until they reach the age of 20. It's not enough that she's a gedola. That was instituted by the Rabbanan as a protection against stupid kids who don't know what they're doing, and we want them to be of age before they start selling their father's property to buy first class tickets on airlines, Richie. And therefore, we need to protect the estate. And over here, it says gidola. So why is that really true? It should say only if she's 20 years old, right? So why exactly would she have the rights? There's all kinds of discussions about this, whether she actually does get the rights over here because it was a field that was bought after the father died. Therefore, it's not really part of the estate. It was set aside as a trust fund and so on. You can see that there's a lot of issues that need to be taken into consideration, but don't jump to any conclusions just because it says gedola. Now, so the question is, in this case, Tana Rabba, somebody who's mashlish ma'ot l'chatano l'kach me'am sada levito. So suppose somebody gives money, sets up a trust fund that's going to ultimately benefit his son-in-law, right? But because he gets to eat from Nichsei Malug or Nichsei Tzon Barzel, so he told him, buy this land, and it'll become, depending on how they write it up in the Ketuvah, either Malug or Tzon Barzel, which basically is what the Mishnah talked about, right? L'chora. So, he omer tinat nu l'vali, and she says, no, just give the money to my husband. So then it depends. So if this takes place after they already went to the chuppah, so then she has a right to say that. And because the trust fund was only set up until she's actually married, he took for granted that by that point, the shalish would already have bought the field and this situation wouldn't have come up. And therefore, says Rabbi Meir, if it's after the nisuin, then she could say that because that was the end of the trust. Mina erisin, but if it's only after erisin, he still has to do exactly what he was told to do. Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Yossi says, that's not the issue. The issue is how old is she? If she is a gedola, so then who cares whether it's mina nisuin or mina erisin? Since it's in her hands to do what she wants anyway after we buy it, so then what's the point of wasting money and paying taxes and going through the old rigmarole? Just give her the money because she said she's going to want it for her husband anyway. So then her should be ada. If she's a ketana, so then who cares whether it's nisuin or erisin? I don't know why Rabbi Meir is bringing up nisuin or erisin. The bottom line is, if she's a ketana, her words don't count for anything. And therefore, I agree that the shalish should do whatever he was told to do, and that we, even whatever she says, I don't care if it's after nisuin, he still doesn't have a right to change it. Now, it's not clear what area was the machlokas between them, right? Because on the one hand, Rabbi Yossi said beferish. I think the only issue is Gersh, you okay there, sweetie? You got that Richie look to you. So so I say the only issue is, says Rabbi Yossi, is she a gdola or is she a ketana? That's all. Don't give me this erisin and suing because that's irrelevant. Okay, he said that beferish. Rabbi Meir did not say anything about how old she is. All Rabbi Meir spoke about is this erisin or nisuin. So in other words, was the trust account still in effect? But I mean, so what does that mean? Does it mean that he doesn't care? And even if she's a ketana, I'm not quite sure what Rabbi Yossi holds. So I mean, it could be that they're arguing about specifically if it's erisin. And only if it's Erison plus she's a ketana. I mean, I don't know. He didn't explain himself. So what we could say is that the machlokas is if she's a ketana, right? So whether it's nisuin and whether it's Erison, that is what was clear in Rabbi Yossi. And Rabbi Meir is saying that if she's married at the chuppah, but she's still a ketana, so then Rabbi Meir is saying, okay, but still she could say, don't buy me a field. And Rabbi Yossi is saying, I don't care if she's a ketana. I don't care if she's even married. Only a gedola has the right to threaten us by what she's going to do. And that's the only reason we would allow the trustee not to keep his trusteeship. Other than that, no way. So gedola in ketana lo. But if that's what you think, now it's very reasonable, but if that's what you think, I'd like you to explain the last piece of the mission, okay? And what does it say in the last piece over there? Now, who wrote that last piece? Okay, man katanila. Was it Rabbi Meir who wrote it? Was it Rabbi Yossi who wrote it? Because if you think it was Rabbi Yossi, then it's not adding anything. Because Rabbi Yossi already said in the Reisha that all I care about is whether she's a gedola. That's what he said. And the Amar Rabbi Yossi, who was he talking about there? It's only a field. She could sell the field if she wants. Well, obviously, he doesn't own. She could sell the field if she wants. She's a ketana. Nobody owns a ketana can engage in real estate sales. So that means essentially, Rabbi Yossi already told you, I'm only talking about a gedola, right? So why would he have to repeat it at the end of the mission and say, obviously, that's what you said. So gedola de bat zvinin, obviously was only referring to a case where she's already an adult. If she is a ketana, where she couldn't sell it, then he doesn't have any argument, right? So we have no choice but to say that the last words in the Mishnah is Rabbi Meir's statement, but it doesn't make any sense. What do you mean by medvar mamurim, that what? That we listen to her? I thought Rabbi Meir said we don't listen to her. Ah, therefore, the only way to understand the Mishnah is that there's a couple of words missing, which is, it's going only to Rabbi Meir, but it's missing these words, chesuri mechasra. And what it should have said was, Rabbi Meir says, yaseh shalish mashu shlash biyado. Very good. Now, insert the words. Bamed varim amurim mina erusin. Avo mina nisuin harashut biyada. And then go back to what it says over here. So as Rabbi Meir is saying that if she's already married, that then she can say, listen, don't bother buying the field. But when is that true? Comes along the Sefer to add a little bit of Rabbi Meir. Bamed dvarim amurim bigdola, where she could have sold it. Alva bigtana, ein maaseh ketana klum. So in other words, when Rabbi Meir said in the Brisa that if it's after Nisuin, we listen to her. He didn't mean we listen to anybody. It means we listen to a gedola. So then that means the only machlokes between him and Rabbi Yossi is where it wasn't Nisuin, it was Erisin, and she's a gedola. Rabbi Meir says, look, you are a trustee. You got to do what it is that you were told to do. Mashenken, if the trusteeship had completed because it's already the Nisuin, so then it makes sense to do what is ultimately most effective. Okay. So then that means we will never listen to the Ktana, whether it's before or after Nisuin. Ela gedola mina eris. That's the only issue. There is what's ikabinai. Itmar. What's the halacha? Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel says the halacha is like Rabbi Yossi. Rav Amar Reb Nachman says the halacha is like Rabbi Meir. And you remember the story of Ilfa's attempted suicide, where basically what happened was, if you remember the story, Rabbi Yochanan and Ilfa were having very difficult financial times. And so they decided that they're going to go together. It was a very nice chavrusa. They're going to go together and open up a business. And they'll both get rich, and then they'll come back and they'll learn as much as they can while they're away. Anyway, they're about to depart, and Rabbi Yochanan hears the voice of a malach saying, one of these guys is going to be a big Rosh Hashiva. So he says to Ilfa, did you hear anything? I hear nothing. Well, you're having hallucinations. So Rabbi Yochanan decides it must be a message to him. So he says, never mind, I'm staying. Sure enough, he becomes the Rosh Hashiva, and they give him his parnasa and whatever else. Now, Ilfa comes back years later, having made his money, and they say to Ilfa, you know, such a shame you left, because if you hadn't left, you were always the bigger one between you and Rabbi Yochanan. We would have made you Rosh Hashiva. But now, you know, you don't know enough for us to make you Rosh Hashiva. You've been away for so many years. So Ilfa goes, ties himself up to the top of a mast on one of these hornblower ships, and there he is on that little thing, and he says, if anybody can present to me any brisa, which you think I haven't had time to learn, and I can't prove to you that I already know this brisa directly from the Mishnah, and I don't need your guys' crummy brisas where you think you have to spell it out because people who know how to learn will tell you where it is in the Mishnah. If you catch me on any of this, I'm cutting the ropes and falling into the sea to drown. Okay, so this is what happened. So here's Ilfa on top of the mast. And he says, okay, Ika Deati de Amarli Milton de Reb Chiya Reb Hoshaya, I know your big prices that the Reb Chiya has been working on. If I can't tell him where this comes from in a Mishnah, Nafila Mis Kariya Vatavana, I'm jumping and drowning. Anyway, of course, Eliyahu Navi couldn't resist this one, you know. So it comes along, Ahud Saba, and he says, okay, I got a question for you. Here's a brisa. The brisa says, if somebody says before his death, so he says to a trustee, he says, give one shekel to my children every week for their mizonos. And it turns out that the price of food is going up and so on. What they really need to survive is two shekels, which is a sellout. So then the trustee can give them a sellout. But if he says, al titnu lehem ela shekel, don't give them more than a shekel, then we'll only give them a shekel and not a sellout. If he says, in either event, if he says, if these children die, then I want the trust fund to be given to so-and-so, then it doesn't matter how he phrased it, because then obviously he's trying to preserve the trust fund, and he really doesn't want more than a shekel to be given them. Okay, says Ahud Saba, I dare you, Ilfa. Where is the Mishnah for that one, huh? Says Ilfa, what do you mean? It's obvious. It's this Mishnah. It's going, I'll leave it to Rebbe Meir. Didn't Rebbe Meir says, a trustee only does what he's been entrusted to do. Okay, so what's the basis of that? Mitzvah lekayem divrei amet. Our Mishnah has created that halacha. I don't need this prize. Next, please. Amar b'chista amar mar ukva. Hilchata ben shamar tnu, ben shamar al titnu ela. It's all the same. The father obviously meant to give them what they really need to survive, unless, of course, he said he wants the money to be passed on to someone else. You give them whatever they need. What? You just said the halacha is like Rebbe Meir, and it's a mitzvah l'kayim divrei amet, and now you're saying, no, it's not. Do what needs to be done. Yeah, that's in other cases, not in this case. What do you think daddy really meant, okay? Do you think daddy really meant, let's starve out my kids? No, daddy really meant, don't make life easy on my kids so that they become a bunch of slobs relying on money coming in from the bank. Teach them the value of money like any parent, you know. Teach them the value of money. Let them get a job. Let them do something for themselves. I didn't mean to starve them out. So if in Lemaisa, yeah, trust fund kids, exactly. So if in Lemaisa, the price of food went up and now he's going to be starving them out. That he never meant to do. So we understood that in this case, it's different. The only reason he said only give them a shekel is because Lazarozinu with the Asa. He wants them to be Mizaris, them to not to be sitting back in an easy chair. Now, we also have a Mishnah in Gittin that says that if you have little kids, the Chachomi made a takana, little kids that are homeless and are out on the street, are really in tough position. They're going to end up turning to prostitution. What else are they supposed to do? So what they did was they were mitakein, that even though normally children do not have the rights to buy and sell, because in Maisa Ketana Klum, as we said, but in such a case, we give them the right, min rabbanan, that the mekach is binding legally and the sell is binding legally if we're not talking about real estate, if we're talking about metaltolim. So if a kid opens up a lemonade stand and you're going to buy lemonade, it's got all of the dinim of a real business. Well, marafram, but that's only true if there's no trustee. She'ain shama apotropos. Now, an apotropos is not precisely the same thing as a trustee. Why? Because an apotropos is not given specific instructions. He's just in charge of their life, and he makes all of the decisions. So the trustee has a specific job to do. So in a case, if there's an apotropos, then if there's no apotropos, then fine. We have to give them the rights to support themselves. But if there's an apotropos, then we don't give them this right. And there, ein mikran mekach ve'ein mimkaran mecha. How do I know? From this Mishnah that we just learned. Because it says, ein ma'asek tana klum. Anything that she would do would be completely meaningless. So our Mishnah is saying that more than just the idea over here, we said that she doesn't have any kind of rights. It's saying that in this case, we don't have an apotropos. We had a shalish. The shalish is given a specific instruction. So if there's an apotropos, so then whatever it would be that would be done would be basically considered to be the act of the mace. I understand, but how does Ein Ma'asek Tana Klum prove anything? Because that is talking about where we have a shalish. So Dilma Echadika Shalish Shiny. You can't compare a shalish to an apotropos. A shalish was told do X, but an apotropos is just a general in charge. So it could very well be that if the katana in this case would sell it, since the person who appointed the apotropos, either the Bezdin or the father himself before he died, he didn't say specifically do this, go buy this, or don't sell this. So maybe over there would be okay, because we don't have a specific instruction of the mate. True, says the Gemara. I'm not bringing a raya from the case in the Mishnah. I'm bringing a raya from the lashon of the Mishnah. It should simply have said in the Mishnah, Avo biktana, if she was still a ktana, yaseh shalish bashur shlash biyado. That's all you need to say. Why do you throw in the words, Ein ma'aseh ktana klum? Okay, that's coming to teach me something. And therefore, the Mishnah was coming to say, you should know, even in the event that we wouldn't have a shalish, we would have a general apotropos, you can't do anything. Ein ma'aseh ktana klum. And that indeed is a good raya to this principle that we don't give in a mokum of apotropos rights to ketanim. Hadron alach mitziyata yisha.
Me leather.